Tom, you get the first question.
I would just like to, because of your long background in this, just touch for a moment on what the declining price of crude oil may mean to the economy overall and the slightly strengthening dollar. It's a rather optimistic sort of a development, right?
It is, and of course everybody is now looking at the tea leaves to try to decide what caused it, and we probably won't ever really know. I think there are several items that have caused it to come down, the price of oil. Let's hope that they are permanent. I think that President Bush's statement that the administration's, the executive branch's moratorium on drilling in the Outer Continental Shelf caused a significant impact. And many of your listeners will say, well, why? Because that won't take place for at least 5, maybe even as long as 10 years. One of the things that you have to understand with respect to the oil market or any market, number one, it is a world market, not a national market. So what we do in the United States is only influential, but it is not controlling. We have to have the attention of everybody else in the world because oil is set on the world price. Number two, the one thing any market hates is uncertainty. And up until the time President Bush made that announcement, there was uncertainty as to whether or not there would be any additional sources of supply coming online at any point in the future. And as long as you have uncertainty about what supply will be, you want to own some oil futures. And that means people were buying oil futures and bidding the price of them up. The idea that there would be some certain supply available at some point in the future caused the market to say, okay, maybe we don't want to own oil futures at this high price. Maybe we should wait till the price comes down a little. And that took some of the buying pressure off. Number two, the rapid increase in oil prices was beginning to look like the bubble that we had with rapid increase in home prices. Remember, everybody was always sure that the price of homes would never, ever turn downward. Before that, it was the rapid bubble in dot-com stock prices. I don't know that this is a classic bubble because there are supply and demand pressures pushing it upward. But we were beginning to see some indications that there was a bubble driven by speculation, and bubbles always burst. Now, if indeed this is a bubble that has burst and the price is going to come down, we need to do whatever we can to make sure that uncertainty on supply continues to disappear. And I think that's why the Congress should follow the president's lead with respect to drilling in the Outer Continental Shelf, and we should do something about oil shale, and those things will help bring the price down. And you say, how will that help the economy? How will it affect the economy? Let's just talk about food prices. A year ago, the portion of the price in the grocery store that represented transportation and therefore was sensitive to oil prices was half what it is today. The increase in oil prices, the increase in gasoline prices, has driven transportation costs up to the point where it has impacted the price of food, and that ripples through the economy and everything that happens. So an easing of the oil price will have a very significant and beneficial effect on virtually everything we buy, and as we get price stability, that means the economy will begin to feel more comfortable. Once again, the uncertainty of what's going to happen on price will begin to disappear, and the markets, I think, will reflect that in the form of more optimism and a little more stability. That's a long economic answer, but your question went to the heart of many of the problems that we're trying to address here in Washington. Let's go to Bruce Mayhew.
Thank you, Senator. On the development of oil shale, you have some conservation groups that are saying that we're 10 to 12 years out before we can bring oil shale to market to make it economically viable. You have some oil companies that are saying they can drill tomorrow and make it economically viable within a short period of time. And then Secretary Kempthorne said that we're just a few years out. Where are we really at with oil shale development as far as how quick could we bring it to market?
I think Senator Kempthorne is probably right. Technically, yes, there are technologies that could start to produce oil shale very, very quickly. And there's a program underway in Utah, a pilot project, which shows every sign of having some oil shale available, or oil out of oil shale available by the end of this year, but not in massive amounts. They're talking something like 10,000 barrels a day, which sounds pretty good, but if we're going to affect the world price of oil, we've got to be talking about 1 million barrels a day. And to get to that level of production is going to require an investment of billions of dollars, and you don't invest billions of dollars in a matter of a month or two. So we're, at best case, I think maybe 3 to 5 years away. The challenge is that in order to get the kind of volume that would give you 1 million barrels a day, you have to access federal lands. The pilot project that's going on in Utah is on state land, and there simply isn't enough state land to provide enough volume of shale to produce any commercially viable amount of oil. Oil shale, one of the arguments that conservationists have made against it is that the amount of oil in the rock involved is relatively small, and they say, gee, the yield is terribly small. Actually, if you have enough rock, as we've proved with the copper mine in Utah, even though the percentage is relatively small, if you've got enough rock, you can get enough product out of it without too much difficulty. But to get that volume, you're going to have to go on public lands. And that's why the current moratorium placed by the Democratic Congress on any development of the rules with respect to oil shale has got to be lifted before anybody will start doing anything. Now, just a few days ago, the Interior Department issued a draft of the rule. And basically what they're saying is this is what the rule would be if the Congress were to lift the moratorium. And so people who know the rules of the game could then start thinking about getting into the game. But until that moratorium is lifted, no one can even apply for a lease because the rules under which the leases would be offered have still not been made final. So that's where we are. I think 10 to 12 years, maybe that's right for massive volumes. But 3 to 5 years, I think that's where we are for the kind of volume that would get everybody's attention and put a little certainty into the market. Tom Busselberg in Davis County.
Yes, Senator, in your speech before the Senate Wednesday, you urged Americans to get back in the game. You talk about speculation, ask whether real market manipulation is going on, and can it be discovered and dealt with. Can you expound on those thoughts?
Sure. As I said in the speech, prices, of course, are set by the balance between supply and demand. And if you have enough access to supply, you can influence the price. And for many, many years, decades, we in America had the ability to control the world oil price because the Texas Railroad Commission, that's kind of an interesting name for a group that controls oil leases. But because the leases were reached originally by rail, why, that's the group that did it. The Texas Railroad Commission could control the world price of oil simply by licensing a few more wells in East Texas. There was enough oil in East Texas, as far as world demand was concerned, that if the price was getting too high, the Texas Railroad Commission could just commission a few more wells, and the price could come back under control. Sometime in the 1970s, the ability to control the world price of oil shifted away from America and the Texas Railroad Commission and went overseas, specifically to the Saudi royal family. The worldwide demand for oil was such that the United States could no longer be the definitive player in determining what it would be, and the Saudi royal family took over that role. Now, the worldwide demand for oil is so high that even when the Saudis announce that they're going to increase production, it doesn't have that much effect on world prices. And we've seen that recently when the Saudis did say they were going to increase their production. And then there was a problem in Nigeria, and the Nigerians went off the market while they dealt with the insurgency there, an attack on the government. And the loss of the availability of Nigerian oil more than offset the increase of availability of Saudi oil, and the oil price continued to go up. Now, if we could get back to where we were in the days when America could influence the world supply, we could have a very significant impact. So that's what I meant when I said, let's get back in the game. Because since the 1970s, we have not been increasing American production of oil in any significant way, even though there is oil in Alaska, there's oil in the outer continental shelf, and as we've been discussing, there's oil in the shale in the mountains of Utah, Colorado, and Wyoming. By not developing those resources over the last 30 years, we have allowed leadership in world pricing to go to the Saudis and remain there. It's time we said, okay, we want to be players again in determining what the world oil price will be. And that's why, along with a number of other Republicans, over 45 of us now, I think, we have sponsored the Gas Price Reduction Act, which focuses on increasing supply in the outer continental shelf off our shores and through oil shale, and that's what we can do to get us back into the game. All right, Jenny Christensen.
Senator, as you know, T. Boone Pickens has this huge TV advertising program going, promoting his own plan for solving the energy crisis. Have you heard the details, and do you believe him when he says we can't drill our way out of the crisis?
Well, I have talked to Boone Pickens. Yes, I do believe him in the plan that he's pushing. And I've said to him, will you please take the tagline, we can't drill our way out of this crisis, off your ads, because it isn't true. And you yourself don't believe it, because as he talks to us about his push for wind and natural gas, he stresses in his conversations, by pushing wind and natural gas, I'm in no way saying you should not be developing oil. And we said, well, we're glad to know that you're smart enough to understand that. But the language you are using in your ad leads people to believe that the contrary is true. Will you please change the language in your ad? And he promised that he would. He said he would take that off, and he would go instead to making it clear that he supports everything that we are calling for in the Gas Price Reduction Act. So I think the fellows who wrote the copy for his ad just didn't realize the economics of what they were talking about, and they didn't pay that much attention to what he has said. So while he's pushing natural gas and wind, he's also saying we have to consider all options. And in a very real way, he's supporting the position that we take in the Gas Price Reduction Act, which position is we need to find more and we need to use less. And as the first member of the Senate to start driving a hybrid car, I hope that gives me a little bit of credibility to say we're serious when we say use less. We're not just the find more side of things. Okay, let's go back to Tom Jordan.
Oh, okay. The housing bill has just passed.
Yes.
I know it's not a perfect bill, much of anybody's eyes, but is this a good solution right for the moment?
Several reasons are why I voted for it. The economists to whom I speak, in whose judgment I have the greatest trust, said, well, it won't hurt anything. And maybe that's small comfort in Washington, but there are those who insist that it would be very, very damaging, and I've tried to reach out for the expert opinion to see if there's people who agree with that, and there are others who are saying, no, this won't hurt anything. Will it help? Once again, the answer to that goes back to the question of confidence and certainty. The market hates uncertainty. The market hates any sense of lack of confidence. And the very fact that the government is taking steps to try to provide some certainty with respect to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, or in government talk, the GSEs, that stands for government-sponsored enterprises, 70% of the mortgage market is run through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, through the GSEs, and there has been uncertainty with respect to their regulator. So the most significant and valuable part of this housing bill is the establishment of a properly funded, properly staffed regulator with the kind of authority to see to it that the difficulty that the GSEs got in previously doesn't happen again. The regulator that has been overseeing them for a long time has been very weak, both with his powers and with his abilities to do research and understand what's really going on. And in this bill, we strengthen the regulators. The housing part, the activity with respect to FHA and so on, probably won't do any harm, may do some good, but tying it to the regulator was the thing that I think made it possible for it all to pass. Now, I've got to be clear, what we did today was approve cloture, which means we can get to the bill and the formal passage will occur tomorrow. But de facto, yeah, the bill passed today when cloture was approved, and it has passed the House. All right, Bruce Mayhew.
Thank you, Senator. You mentioned in a news release that the MSHA report on the Crandall Canyon mine disaster was disturbing. My question is why is it that mining companies don't take the higher road and provide more safety precautions and measures in the mines that they operate rather than relying on something that happened to Crandall Canyon and then after the fact decide to do more, have more safety regulations? Why is it that they don't do that in advance? Is there any reason from the federal level that they don't? Or
my reading of the report is, of course, very disturbing because there were a number of indications in advance of the final cave-in that if they had been reported to MSHA, would have made it very clear that they would have stopped the mining. They would have shut the thing down. And MSHA has issued the highest allowable fine that they can issue under the law. They have hit Murray Energy with as high a penalty as the law allows them under this case, and I'm sure there will be more action as we go forward. What I hope, as I read this, is that this is not typical. I would hope that the other mining companies would not have acted in this particular way. It's hard to believe that everybody would be as irresponsible as this initial report indicates that Murray was. Now, if there's going to be a court case, and I expect there probably will be, we have to abide by the innocent until proven guilty principle outlined in the Constitution and make no final judgments. But if I were connected in any way to a mining company reading this report, the first thing I would do would be to turn to the CEO of that company and say, we aren't doing anything like this, are we? In our company, we are performing in a much different kind of way. And if the answer was not a clear and unequivocal, yes, we are performing in a different way, I would have nothing to do with that company and probably would call MSHA and say, you need to pay some more attention to this. So, yeah, it was very disturbing, and I'm sure the members of the families are heartsick to find that there were advance indications that something that what did happen, something like that could have happened. Let's go to Tom Busselberg.
Yes, Senator. Hill Air Force Base continues to gain backing and support from the Senate. I was wondering if you could comment on the latest allocations that it sounds like are moving forward on the new F-22 facility and
yes.
Other facilities?
Well, we were always excited about the FA-22. I've seen it in action. I've been to the the training field where pilots are given their first shot at it, and they are ecstatic about the kind of airplane it is. And the savings over time that will come from the maintenance of the FA-22, it will be much more efficient than the F-16 and much easier to repair and maintain. We were always sure that Hill would be the ideal spot for FA-22 maintenance, and now the Air Force has made it clear that they agree. The last BRAC round, where we were all working very, very hard to make sure the Hill story was properly told, is turning into a bonanza for Hill, as the Air Force has realized, as a result of the analysis that went into BRAC, that Hill is a major, major asset to this country and therefore to the defense of the world. And it's a tribute to the workforce at Hill, a tribute to the permanent party placed there by the Air Force, that Hill continues to command that kind of respect. So I believe that the future of Hill Air Force is very bright. Okay, Jenny Christensen.
I don't know if you've read it yet or not, but today the Salt Lake Tribune has an editorial that says the world is watching as Congress drags its feet on a radioactive waistband. So I'd like to know how you feel about Energy Solutions' request to import this low-level radioactive waste from Italy.
Well, people should understand that Energy Solutions is indeed, play on words, part of the solution with respect to nuclear power. Nuclear power does produce the high-level spent fuel rods, and we're still working on how we deal with those. But in addition to those, there is a very low-level nuclear waste that must be dealt with, that has been dealt with successfully and safely in Utah for decades. And if the Utah facility in Clive, Utah, were to shut down, it would significantly impact the 20% power source. The United States gets 20% of its electricity now from nuclear power, and it would affect that power source negatively. And we need to pay attention to that. Now, the Energy Solutions at one of their other facilities in the country is receiving nuclear waste from Italy and reprocessing it. And the question is, once it has been reduced to the same level of low-level waste as the waste that they are currently processing in Clive, Utah, should this be sent back to Italy, or should it join the rest of the waste that is being placed in Utah, coming from the other nuclear plants, and be put in Utah? I think from a scientific standpoint, there's no particular reason why it should not. However, there are other considerations that go into this that we're looking at. One of the interesting things that people don't know when they're saying, gee, we don't want any foreign waste, a very large percentage of the nuclear power that is being produced on the east coast of the United States right now comes from former Soviet Union weaponry. That is, it's Russian waste, if you want to put it in that fashion. And because it's very much in everybody's interest to have those nuclear weapons turned into nuclear power, we have welcomed that source into the United States, processed it in the United States, and then the low-level nuclear waste, because it comes out of American plants, then comes to Utah, and no one seems to be disturbed about it, and I'm not disturbed about it. I think we need to look at the long-established policy that Congress has set with respect to the importation of foreign low-level radioactive waste, and examine whether or not we want to change it. Because the current policy is that governors have the power to either approve or deny the storage in their state. And Governor Huntsman, of course, has made his position very clear with respect to this particular source. I think we ought to examine the current standing policy, see if we want to change it before we get really excited about it. It's a long-term issue. if we are going to have more nuclear power in the United States, which I favor, we're going to have to say, well, no, more nuclear power means more low-level waste. And a lot of Utahns take pride in the fact that no better or more efficient or safer facility for dealing with the low-level waste exists than the one that exists in Utah and provides jobs for Utahns that are there. So I want to wait and see what the NRC says about the case and see what comes of the pending court case before I come down hard and fast on any one particular position. Okay, I'll try to be quick in the time we remaining. Tom Jordan.
I know. Always a problem. I'm quick here. The just very briefly, because you've been up on the subject of Iraq, what do you make out of the call by Nouri al-Maliki to have the U.S. leave Iraq? Is that just politics on his end?
Frankly, I don't know. I've not had a briefing on it, so all I know about that is what I read in the papers. And with all due respect to all of you that produce papers, sometimes you need a little bit more than that before you can make a definitive position. What is clear is that the surge has worked. The surge has worked extremely well, and they understand that in Iraq, and reluctantly, there are even some politicians in America who are beginning to understand that. Bitter pill for some of them to swallow because they opposed it, but it's very clear that the situation in Iraq is substantially better for everybody, for us, for the Iraqis, and for the world than it was a year ago. Bruce Mayhew.
Okay, thank you, Senator. Just one quick final question about the alternative sources of fuel. Some groups have been comparing oil shale development with alternative sources of fuel, saying oil shale, there's no profit in it and things like that. Well, what profit is in the alternative or renewable sources of fuel? Obviously, there's not a big world demand for that as there is oil. What do you see? Is it convenient, affordable,
well,
dependable?
First, if there's no profit in oil shale, nobody will do it. It's just as simple as that.
Right.
And so far, all of the profit in the wind and solar has come as a result of federal tax subsidies. If you take the tax subsidies out, there is no profit there. They are claiming that with massive increases and higher volume, the profit will come and ultimately the subsidies will have to disappear. I hope that is true, and I'm willing to continue to support the subsidies while we try to find out. But the big problem with wind and solar is that the wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine. And furthermore, the efficiency may be fine for an individual windmill, but if you're trying to produce massive amounts of energy, the massive amount of land it would take to build that many windmills or build that many solar reflectors is very significant. So I do not expect that wind and solar will ever be as major a source of energy that we can get from nuclear or hydro or clean coal technology or some of the other aspects. If we're going to bridge ourselves to a carbon-free world, the bridge is going to be built out of fossil fuels, and everybody recognizes that that is, in fact, the case. Tom Busselberg.
Yes, and I understand that the Foreclosure Prevention Act of 2008 is being debated or has been debated this week. What are the highlights of this bill, and do you believe that they go far enough, would be effective in working to stem the crisis in this country with foreclosures?
Well, the best thing that can happen to the housing world is to get stability back there, and the bill that we voted cloture on and that will pass tomorrow is the first step in that direction. I think we will wait to see what happens as a result of that before we do any more legislation. Foreclosure is, of course, a very emotional and financially ruinous thing for anybody who goes through it. But the foreclosure process is in place now, and a federal legislation would be a little slow in trying to do it. The bill that we have passed will include a $3.9 billion program to allow local governments to buy and rehabilitate foreclosed properties, and we hope that will help. Jenny, you get the last question.
Briefly, how do you view Barack Obama's trip overseas overall and what it will do to help or hurt his campaign?
I think it's brilliant politics because he gets a backdrop that everybody wants to put on television, and it's new and different, and in today's 24-hour news cycle on the cable system, they desperately need something new and different to try to get their viewers. Showing John McCain at yet another town hall in New Hampshire somehow doesn't do it if you can go someplace else. And so Obama, I think, has done very, very smart political thing. When he gets home, however, he's going to discover that the number one issue in this election at this moment, and I got it again when I was in the 24th of July parade, people shouting at me from the sidelines, drill now, the number one issue is high gas prices. And a temporary respite from that issue by going to the great photo ops opportunities in Europe is not going to change that, and I think when he gets home, he's got to have some kind of acceptable answer to the challenge of the high gas prices, or the pretty pictures from Europe are going to fade between now and November.
Thank you.
Thank you all. It's always good to be with you. This is Bob Bennett in Washington at another statewide radio news conference. Looking forward to the next one.
Thank you, Senator.
You bet.